Hello and welcome to another edition of the Financial Markets Insights podcast in conversation with. And today I'm delighted to be joined by someone I've known for quite a long time. I've worked alongside in various industry activities, but today for the first time I have the pleasure of having a conversation with him directly. Welcome, Stéphane Mallery.
Thank you, Tina, for the invitation. I'm really happy to be with you today.
That's great. So we'll start as we do. Tell us a little bit about your background, how you actually came to end up working in the city and particularly in financial markets.
Yes, it's a long story, but I try to make it short. I did a computer engineering degree in Paris. It was a software engineering school, and I didn't know too much that I wanted to go into finance. And I did an internship at the end of the school in the US for a company called Sucden, was a sucre denrée in French. We did a commodities trading, soft commodities, so coffee, sugar, cocoa. I learned a lot from them about the environment of trading companies and also the vibe in the US in New York, being at that time, this was like was 30 plus years ago. Yeah. And it was quite interesting. So this was the entry into the banking system and to go to Salomon Brothers Bank, who doesn't exist anymore. But this is when I moved to London around 30 years ago, from New York to London, to be part of that team, continue to develop this soft commodity swap market. And in fact, I was a kind of the junior developer of the things, and I was in the Telex room, which this doesn't exist anymore as well. But it was an interesting experience to learn all the British accent into that Telex room. Fast forward a bit from that experience, my swaps pricing experience was the development of the fixed income swap market interest rates derivative product. And I got recruited by JP Morgan to join there to manage a small team to create a swap pricing. And this is probably a big turn into my career because JP Morgan, I stayed 10 years at JP Morgan and I work between London, Paris, New York. And so that was probably my big start in the FX market when I work for JP Morgan in New York. And at the time, JP Morgan was still growing their FX franchise. They were not number one. They're probably in the top 10 at most. But it was the beginning of the electronification of market, the development of a single dealer platform for that bank. It's a time where FXall was being created, Centradia was a competitor of FXall was being created, and 360T was in the thinking as well, was not even there. So I saw the growth of the single dealer platform in FX and also the growth of the multi-dealer platform in FX because they were all trying to be created. So this is probably like 20 to 25 years ago, the emergence of those trading venues. I was approached by a Société Générale who was running a bit behind on their electronic distribution technology stack and was quite impressed with what's done by JP Morgan. So I joined Société Générale for 8 years and I did a lot of trips between London and Paris, but I was based in London. And it was a great experience because even there we had the budget to invest into a single dealer platform. And this was at the time where the visualization and the UI was quite important. There was a big war at the time between the Citi's, Barclays, the Deutsche Bank to compete on the single dealer platform front. So there was a lot of work done on the design of this UI and the user ability to use the platforms. So I stayed quite long there for 8 years, and then I was approached by ING Bank. And I joined them to develop that the third time, this e-commerce strategy, e-commerce distributions, how to approach clients.
So, of course, Stéphane, we met originally through our respective involvement within the FX industry and specifically around the stuff we both did with the ACI. But I think you have a broader asset class remit.
When I was at Société Générale and then also at ING Bank, this is where I expand my scope, not only to FX, but to fixed income, commodities, products. So in fixed income, it was corporate bonds and credit bonds and interest rate derivative. And so I had a broader view of what we call the FIC, FICC world. And this is where, you know, I started to be called the non-equity guy because I never really touched the cash equity business, but all the other asset class were kind of under my remit and tried to become great at it, you know. So my challenge was in front of fixed income people being the fixed income guy and in front of the FX people being the FX guy, trying to be expert into those domains. FX was quite electronically already, but fixed income was still in the last 10 years in the growth area of the electronification of the fixed income market, with platforms like Bloomberg, Tradeweb, MarketAxess in Europe growing rapidly. And we had to manage that electronification because from an ING Bank point of view, there was a catch-up to do. And there was good investment and focus from the management team to develop that capabilities. So a very good experience. ING was great as well because it was a very innovative bank. Innovation for me was like the next level of digitalization. What's going to happen next? So of course there was digital assets. The crypto world was booming and trying to look at how the banks can enter to that ecosystem. Data analytics was very important. How do you manage and use your data in a better, more efficient way? And AI came about in the last 2 years and became a very big and important topic for that. So innovation for me was two things. Yeah, my role was head of market structure and innovation for the market business of ING. So market structures was really working with policymaker, industry body, central banks, regulators, to represent the interests of the bank and the community, to try to understand how we can progress the innovation further with change of regulation. And the innovation hat was more working with fintech companies.
So that's quite an interesting shift, isn't it? Engaging with fintechs and working with them as service providers to financial institutions rather than being a client of their services.
So I met a lot of fintech companies like 6 years, and this was so energetic for me to try to see the passion and the mood that those people have to try to solve key problems for the bank. And the good way for us at ING was at the time to either become a client of those fintech companies, so to meet them to see if there was a demand for our desk and which desk was a better suit to them, but to help them to grow as well. Say if a young fintech were lacking of data, for example, can we give them data to test their model and validate if their assumptions are correct? And then if everything was good, we wanted to be a client and the business case was good, then we invest in them. So we had the investment fund. We invested in around 30 to 40 different fintech companies in the last few years. And in the market division, I think that was 5 or 6 fintech companies that we invested. And as part of that, I was on the board of different tech companies to represent the interest of the investors from my bank, to represent the bank. And this is kind of a new story for me. This was almost like the third chapter, or the fourth chapter of my career, to try to learn how to be more strategic at the board level, to be able to represent the investor interest, but also to help the management team of that tech company to grow the company to the next stage. And doing it for more than one company give a lot of value because you learn from the mistake of one, you can apply how to get them better, but it can help the other one as well to help them to grow faster. So having a portfolio of different companies where you are involved in a strategic discussion was very valuable, and I really learned from that experience.
Evidently, Stefan, you're a man of many hats, and we haven't even begun to cover your active involvement in industry associations and organizations.
So I'm the chair of the ACI Financial Market Association, which is more a global association in FX and money market. But I'm also on the board of ICMA, ICMA, which is more on the fixed income side. So that was my two hats. And I was also quite involved with AFME, where I was the chair of the MiFID steering committee, quite a large committee representing a lot of the global banks in the industry. So part of my leadership was more on the policy making, working with regulator central bank, and the other part was more on the fintech side, working in innovation, which is still very linked to the automation of processes, electronic trading, electronic distribution. So I try to make it not too long, but that's my story. I left ING 2 months ago. Now I'm focusing on starting this portfolio career. So I'm still quite involved in the ACI Financial Market Association as the chairman of the board, and also starting with the fintech company. So this is the first time, in fact, I'm working with a fintech company on the consolidated tape for bonds, which is quite a big project close to my heart on the fixed income side, which will go live in less than a year time. So it's going to be a big change for the fixed income market in terms of transparency, usage of data and cost of market data. So 3 big objectives. We're very keen to do it for the UK, but also for Europe.
Well, that was a very, very comprehensive response. Thank you, Stefan. And I knew some of it, obviously, because I've known you quite a while, but some of it was new to me. As I said before, I hadn't factored in that you come from a technology background. What we do have in common is that we both basically came into the city at the time of, in my case, the time of electronification. And I can't remember how long ago we met, but certainly 30 odd years ago when EBS, FXNet and then EBS were being formed. JP Morgan, for example, were one of the pioneering board members that drove that initiative forward from an interbank perspective. And I was trying to think, the first ever single dealer platform I remember before Barracuda was, I've got to say, Autobahn. So it's been an interesting time for ACI, I think, over the years, because it was old school traders. And my word is my bond. And it was very much driven by individuals who were very active on trading floors. And there was a period, certainly back then, where if you were any big bank, you ensured that all of your traders were members, and it became part of the recruitment or part of their employment that they had to be a member of ACI. And obviously technology shifted that a bit, which I think is to the detriment, sadly, of ACI and possibly other industry associations, because it's harder to persuade individuals unless their dealing floor is saying, do this. It's quite hard to compel them, I find. So has it been challenging for you? Have you seen that shift with ACI, particularly in your management role?
Yes, I've been engaged with ACI for close to 20 years now, I would think. And so like you, I joined ACI, the Financial Market Association, where it was probably still at its peak with very big congress, people yes. coming all over the world, traveling, the participation from the global banks, etc. And then it went to a dip, and that now it's starting again to be more relevant for people. And I will explain why. ACI, the challenge and the opportunity from the ACI organization, I think it was created 70 years ago. So this year is the anniversary of the 70 years of this international association. And what is interesting is, because it's probably one of the oldest or the oldest financial market association in the world, it had to evolve over the years. And it was created originally between the traders, the FX traders in Paris, wanted to talk more to the traders in London because they had their local network, right? The Paris dealer knew each other very well and the UK dealer knew each other very well, but the two didn't meet too much 70 years ago. So they had to find a way to communicate better, and that's why they created the ACI. Over the years, the ACI became very international, and now it's present in 60 different countries, and each country have their own national association. So there is ACI UK, ACI France, the two original ones, but you have ACI in Indonesia, in Australia, in Ghana, you know, in South Africa, Portugal, in Spain, in the Nordics countries, so everywhere. And it's true that the challenge that the association faced in the last 10 years were people in the big financial center, they knew each other now. There was less of the need to have this physical meeting. And on top of that, they were trading a lot more electronically between each other. And the new generation of electronic quant are probably less keen to meet in person than the old style of traders who wanted to have a relationship to be able to call someone when something was wrong. So the growth of the ACI Financial Market Association now is mainly in developing countries. Huge growth in Africa, huge growth in the Middle East, huge growth in Asia, because people there still need to meet, still need to learn and develop their skills. So ACI is still very well recognized in those countries for the education program. So the ACI dealing certificate is still valid in a lot of countries where people need to have this certification to be able to work on a trading floor, which is less the case in the developed countries. So that was the education program is still kind of a very key to ACI success. Emerging market country are very strong in growth in ACI. The other thing that is probably less known now, but ACI used to have what they call the model code, which was the previous version of the global code of conduct in FX. And it was very important when there was a lot of abuse on issue and lawsuit in the FX market that the ACI model code was transferred to the central banks as a global code of conduct. And then it was adapted to be able to be on a global basis. So we are still very involved with central banks in the different working groups to work on the evolution of the global code of FX. And because of that, ACI also developed what they call ELAC, e-learning attestation product, which is more institutional products that banks or central banks take for teaching the code of conduct to their staff. And we expanded that not only to FX, but to digital assets and to commodities as well. So people can learn either themselves through the training and certification program or they can learn through their organization, through the e-learning program.
This is quite important, isn't it? Because it's, I think people might need reminding that FX isn't regulated in the way that other asset classes are. So actually, it is a principles-based code that says it's not prescriptive, but it does say here are the rules of polite behavior. And these are the rules of engagement in foreign exchange.
Yeah, because SpotFX is a mean of payment, so it's not considered a financial instrument. And because of that, it's under the direction of the central banks and not the regulator, where derivative, FX forward, NDF, FX swaps are financial instruments, and those are regulated. And so that's why you needed to have both. You need to have a principle-based code of conduct to regulate SpotFX market, or in general, how do you trade in FX? And for derivative FX product, you have the regulation, which is MiFID in Europe and in the UK, who take care of that. So the two work great together. Maybe the last thing on SCI, we continue to have, I think this connection between people is still very important. So we continue to have every year a World Congress. And we move this Congress in different parts of the world every year. And it's a specific one of the 60 countries who takes the leading role to organize it. So last year it was in Jordan, 2 years ago was in Singapore, and we had great events in both places. And this year it's going to be in Paris on the 19th and 20th of June, and we expect to have a lot of people to join us in Paris. We choose Paris because it's the celebration of the 70 years anniversary. It's quite easy for people to commute from the UK, from Europe, but from the Middle East, Africa, and Asia as well. We expect to have a big, big presence from those regional dealers coming to meet each other. So look forward to this one, and we don't know yet where it's going to be next year, but we'll announce it for people in Paris.
It's like the Olympics, isn't it? The handing over of the flag.
Yes.
Yeah, Paris, definitely. I've been to, two Forexes I've been to in Paris. I'm trying to remember when the last one was. But yes, it was always a great event. I just wonder, sometimes dealing with other clients that we do, that again, it's part of a generational thing. I think getting people together who are around, 70 years ago necessarily, but old school together is always lovely. It's getting the young generations engaged. And it's something, it's not particular to the ACI, but it's something we experience quite a lot with other clients. It's quite interesting when we have events. We have lots of fintech clients, financial services, but in terms of the demographic that will come to a networking event, because it's just not their experience. It's not been their lived experience. And obviously the pandemic didn't help, and working from home has an impact on that. I'm all for it. I think the more people engage with each other on a human basis, the better off everybody is in terms of progressing whatever it is, technology, innovation, removing silos. So I'm not quite sure what we do about that.
So we are trying hard. Thanks to some of the local association in ACI, they have a future leader network. So there is one in the UK, there is one in Denmark, I'm sure. There is one in Switzerland that I'm aware, and there is a few more who are being created. So we are going to organize a panel of future leaders at the conference. And that's going to be quite interesting, because now they are going to be on the hot seat trying to tell the older generation, how they see the world, how it's going to be. But sure, it's harder to engage with them. And that's why we put a specific focus on that, to try to see how we can develop that relationship. And I think we are going to create some of those networks in Asia as well now.
Talking also about, I know you're involved with Quorum 15, which is actually the same but different in terms of it has a really innovative approach to bringing together buy and sell side participants to have open debates rather than that always being a bit one-sided, And how did you get involved with them?
Yes, I met Mike Burton, the CEO and founder of Quorum 15, probably 15, 17 years ago when he started. So he started in equity, I'm a non-equity guy, so I was not interested, but he called me when he was creating the fixed income quorum. It's probably more than 15 or plus years. And the idea was to create kind of a breakfast environment where people behind closed door can be open to discuss market issues. So it's very different from the other work I was doing with industry body association, where you are quite open outside, talking to the press, talking to regulators, and making your views very public. There, it was more a closed group meeting of people, like-minded people, but from both sides, the buy side, the sell side, and later on came the infrastructure provider to try to that. And I really like that, because it was a way to learn from your peer, but learn from also your clients and your technology provider, what are their key issues and how can we work as a group to find some solution of them or how can we influence for the market to be better? So it's not at all a lobby group. And that's the challenge from Quorum 15. It was hard to be known externally because it was a closed group. And the name Quorum 15 came because it was 15 people per room. So I started in the fixed income side and really enjoy it. And since I was also an FX guy, I told Mike Burton at the time, said, listen, you should create an FX forum. You should create a... And it took a bit of time to try to put it together and try to understand. The big difference between fixed income and FX is fixed income, you can have very good debate locally because the way you trade fixed income product in Europe is very different than the way you trade it in the US or in Asia, where FX is a global market. So the difference we made there when we created the FX Quorum were to make it global, where people come from all different regions in a global boat. So it's a hybrid format. And I became the chair of that Quorum, and later on I became a non-executive director of Quorum 15 as well. And this evolved over time. Then other groups were created as well, you know, on compliance, that's a good one, on digital asset. I was also pushing to say, because of my innovation hat at the time, I said, we have to do something in digital asset. And what we found in digital asset, it was that it was a challenge in a way that you had two worlds in digital asset. You had the crypto guys, the crypto native were already trading and having their own processes and practices, and the client base were slightly different. And you had the institutional guy who were looking on digitalization and tokenization of existing assets, mainly bonds. The question was, do we keep those groups separate? Do we put them close together because they are very similar topics? And so at the end, we get the best of both worlds. They are separate, but they are together as well because it's very similar topics that we discuss during those quorums. So I was involved in this one as well. And a few weeks ago, I managed to get me into the equities quorum, and that was very interesting because, well, I don't know the cash equity world, but what I realized by going there is that a lot of the topics are very similar. So equity is probably the one with the most automated to some extent. It's traded on exchange, etc. Then you have FX and then you have fixed income. But one of the main topics discussed in equities was consolidated tape, which is something which is also discussed in the fixed income world and how it's going to change the way we use data, how it's going to change or challenge the cost of market data. You know, so market data costs, very big in equities, very big in fixed income, you know, using of data, big in equity, big in fixed income. AI will be the same thing. It's something that we think is going to be, you know, in all the asset classes that we trade, including equity, AI is becoming a big subject. So I was really pleased to be able to learn that and to see. And I think that the value of Quorum 15 is that having those different working groups in different asset class also help to be able to learn from each other. It's well viewed by regulator as well, right? So at this event, but even in some of the quorums, the regulator are invited and they value the way to discuss in a different type of format. They can be a little bit more open that they are normally because it's not a lobby group. So they can ask questions, right? Normally the regulator never, you know, we pitch to them, they don't pitch to us, but I don't think I can reveal because it was behind closed door. But, you know, we had some very good debates on the future of regulation and which direction they could take, you know, and how the market will react if they take that direction versus this direction. And this creates a lot of value for our industry, trying to work closely with the regulator to try to make, how do we evolve this market to a better place?
I think that what you made there, that there's not people pushing an agenda. The antithesis of silos, although you have segregated debates because there's a lot to talk about with what, you know, in each of these, but you are, as of course, then able to share because the people who attend might be members of different forums.
And what is funny about it is they probably join Quorum 15 because they want to push an agenda, but they stay with Quorum 15 because people don't push their agenda, right? So that's what is so unique about this model. You create the trust. And when you get the trust, you get a more open debate. And then you get results because of that. So you learn a lot and you can bring back to your organization a lot of learning.
Well, everybody benefits. Actually, you touched on it earlier, and I think your ING role, that you're circling, you know, you've got the fintechs, the developers, the technology, you know, pioneers. Although that happens obviously in banks, you've got the people purchasing these solutions. you know, the buying and the sell sides, and you've also got regulators, you've got this, all these stakeholders, if you like, that come together to have an open debate because everybody benefits from that. You know, everyone is going to learn from that experience. The regulators hear the pain that the audience is feeling, the buy and sell side can tell vendors exactly what cheeses them off about being asked to pay for or buy. You touched on market data, that would be one of the discussions. You know, it's always evolving, that conversation. And why does it have to be this way? Just because it's always been this way, it doesn't always have to be this way. Well, it's been an absolute joy, as it always is, talking to you, Stefan. Thank you.